Let me just make a few remarks on the midterm exam before we start. Total possible number of points was 125. The range of score went from 125 down to 76. The grading, if I plotted out on A, B, C, D, there were 5 A's, 7 B's, 3 C's, 4 D's. So it's graded on a curve. You'll notice if you look at the percentage, it doesn't follow the percentage official scale of the school. I always try to take the response into account and the grading. If you have any questions about the way in which any question was graded, or you want to see this breakdown of points and how it fell out, I think the best way is to go to talk to the better. But in general, I think you did quite well. So let's go back where we left off. The last session we were talking about census figures in early chapters of the Book of Numbers. That is on your outline, Roman 2, D, 12, B, the men of war numbered and positions assigned. I don't want to get back into the details of that discussion, but you recall on the basis of certain biblical statements, seven nations greater and mightier than you in the land of Canaan, on the basis of what we know about the size of armies of the time, what we know about the size of cities, Jericho being 7 acres, for example, you begin to wonder if we have really understood exactly the language that's used, that is translated in our English versions of 600 some thousand fighting men, 2-3 million total population. I said right at the end of that discussion, I think this is a problem that's in the category of that Latin phrase, non liquet, something on which you cannot speak. There's something going on here that is not fully understood. I don't think I called your attention to a paragraph on page 41 of your citations, and I'll just conclude this discussion by referring you to that. I may have, but I don't think I did. This is from R.K. Harrison's Old Testament Introduction, where at the conclusion of his discussion of census figures in Numbers, he says about a variety of different approaches to interpretation of what's going on. He says, none of these attempts to scale down the Old Testament numbers is able to account satisfactorily for all the data involved. Remember when I talked about it, to translate the Aleph as chieftain or as tenth group or something like that. You still have the problem of the summation of the numbers at the end that adds them all up. So it's difficult for any presently proposed solution to satisfactorily deal with all the data, and then the suggestions made cannot be taken as uniformly valid for purposes of interpretation. If other evidence from Near Eastern sources concerning numbers generally is of any value in this connection, it would imply that the Old Testament numerical computations rest upon, this is his conclusion, rest upon some basis of reality which was quite familiar to the ancients, but which is unknown to modern spell. In other words, there's something going on here we don't fully understand. And that's where I would leave the issue. If you're interested, you can look at some of the references in your bibliography. There's a fair amount of discussion out there to go further. Any question on that before we go on? All right, C under 12 is the Levites are numbered, and their duties assigned, numbers 3:1-4:49. If you turn to Numbers chapter 3, you notice that beginning at verse 1 and following, it talks about the Levites. And down in verses 7 and 8, you read, they are to perform duties for him. Well, go back to 6. The Lord said to Moses, bring the tribe of Levi and present them to Aaron, the priest, to assist him. They are, that is, the Levites, to perform duties for him and for the whole community at the tent of meeting by doing the work of the tabernacle. They are to take care of all the furnishings of the tent of meeting, fulfilling the obligations of the Israelites by doing the work of the tabernacle. So the Levites are given that task of taking care of the tabernacle. And in doing that, they stand in place of the firstborn of all Israelite families. You notice in verse 11, the Lord said, I have taken the Levites from among the Israelites in place of the first male offspring of every Israelite woman. The Levites are mine, for all the firstborn are mine. Now remember, we talked about the tribe of Levi coming to stand with Moses at the time of the golden calf incident. They were blessed in some way for doing that. This may be what the way that is to be interpreted. They were cursed back in Genesis with the blessings of Jacob, not given the tribal inheritance, but now they are given this important task in Israel. But because they are to stand for each of the firstborn of the families of Israel, they also had to be counted. And that's what follows in this chapter, and pretty quickly you're right back into a census problem. You see, verse 14 says, the Lord said to Moses in the desert, count the Levites by their families and clans, count every male among old or more. And that is done. And you find in verse 39, the total number of Levites counted at the Lord's command by Moses and Aaron, according to their clans, including every male month old or more, was 22,000. Now, look at your citations, page 44. Under J.J. Davis and his book on biblical numerology. And he is commenting on this number with respect to the first book. This is really commenting on verses 40-49 of Genesis 3. Because if you go further after that 22,000 Levites, you go further, verse 43 says the total number of firstborn males among all the more listed by name was 22,273. In other words, there were 273 more firstborn males than there were Levites. So there had to be a compensation made for that. And you read in verse 46, to redeem the 273 firstborn Israelites who exceed the number of the Levites, collect 5 shekels. So that's the way the thing was balanced out. But now get back to Davis's comment. Firstborn among the tribes. One of the more perplexing problems encountered in the book of Numbers is the total of firstborn among the tribes. According to the census taken for the purpose of redemption, all the male firstborn of the 12 tribes totaled only 22,273. That's verse 42, or 43.
if the nation had a population of more than a million males, which would probably be the case, if there were 603,550 men at 20 years old and upward, then on the assumption that 22,273 represents the sum total of all firstborn in the nation, there would be only one firstborn to 40 or 50 males. So you see, you're back into another problem. It's a pretty large family. This implies that every father of a family must have begotten or still had 39 to 44 sons. I'm talking about daughters. Generally, the proportion of firstborn in the whole population is 1 to 4. Now, the next paragraph, Davis mentions that Kyle Dalich, in that old classic commentary series on the Old Testament by Kyle and Franz, C.F. Kyle and Franz Dalich, they handle this problem by arguing that this number of firstborn only represents the number born in the space of 13 months or between the Exodus and the time when the law was given. This would seem to indicate, on the basis of the above statistics, there were about 19,000 firstborn in 1 year, and thus bring the numbers in conformity with the probabilities of the historical situation. Well, that's an interesting suggestion, but the problem, it seems to me, is if you go back to verse 43 in the text, what's it say? It says the total number of firstborn males a month old or more listed by name was 22,273. It doesn't say firstborn males born in the last 12 or 13 months. It says the total number of firstborn males among Israelites. So again, I think there's something going on with these numbers that we don't fully understand as far as the way they are put together, the language that is used. And I would just fold this into that larger non-equipped something on which, at this point, I don't think we have adequate information. I don't think that leads you to conclude that the text isn't reliable. I think the text is reliable, properly understood. Any question? Look, if not, let's go on to D. D is the law of jealousy. Numbers 5, verses 11 to 31. The title, Law of Jealousy, for this section really comes out of verse 29. At the end of the section, after describing a procedure to deal with a certain kind of problem, you read in verse 29, this then is the law of jealousy. And it goes on to say, this is the law of jealousy when a woman goes astray and defiles herself while married to her husband, or when feelings of jealousy come over a man because he suspects his wife. Priest is to apply the provisions of this law. If you go back to verse 14, you get a description of what this is to deal with. Well, let me start reading at verse 12. The Lord said, speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man's wife goes astray and is unfaithful to him by sleeping with another man, and this is hidden from her husband, and her impurity is undetected, since there is no witness against her, and she has not been caught in the act. And then you see verse 15 describes the issue. And if feelings of jealousy come over her husband and he suspects his wife and she is impure, or if he is jealous and suspects her even though she is not impure, then he's to do certain things. And that's the law of jealousy, the procedure that is to be followed in that kind of a case. It's a case where there is not evidence, and there are two possibilities. A woman has sinned against her husband. He becomes jealous. He has no proof. But she's guilty. Or a case where a man suspects his wife has sinned. Again, there's no proof. But the woman is innocent. So it's a case where there is no evidence. But the husband is suspicious. And in such a case, there's a procedure outrun here, but that is to be followed. The procedure is not to deal with the alleged offense itself. There was already the death penalty for adultery for both man and woman. But the procedure is to deal with the innocence or guilt of the woman in order to remove jealousy that was unfounded. As well as, I think, to be a deterrent to unfaithfulness, because the procedure would be opposed. Now, what's the procedure? Verse 15 says, if there's a case like this, the husband is to take his wife to the priest. He must also take an offering of a tenth of an ephah of barley flour on her behalf. He must not pour oil on it or put incense on it, because it is a grain offering for jealousy, a reminder offering to draw attention to guilt. So an offering is to be brought, in verse 15. And then in verses 16 to 18, the priest places the woman before the Lord and puts the offering in her hand. Verse 16 says, the priest shall bring her, have her stand before the Lord. He shall take some holy water in a clay jar and put some dust from the tabernacle floor into the water. After the priest has had the woman stand before the Lord, he shall loosen her hair and place in her hands the reminder offering, the grain offering for jealousy, while he himself holds the bitter water that brings the curse. So he places the woman before the Lord, puts the offering in her hand, and then in verses 19 to 22, the woman takes an oath that the Lord uses to either bless or curse her according to her innocence or her guilt. Verse 19, then the priest shall put the woman under oath and say to her, if no other man has slept with you and you have not gone astray and become impure while married to your husband, may this bitter water that brings it first not harm you. But if you have gone astray while married to your husband and have defiled yourself by sleeping with a man other than your husband, here the priest has put the one under this curse of the oath. May the Lord cause your people to curse and denounce you when he causes your thigh to waste away and your abdomen to swell. May this water that brings a curse enter your body so that your abdomen swells and your thigh wastes away. Now that water is this water that's mixed with dust from the tabernacle floor. So the woman drinks this mixture of dust and water, and the result would be as described. If she was innocent, nothing would happen. If she was guilty, her thigh would waste away and her abdomen would swell. I don't think there's any reason to conclude that a mixture of dust and water, such as it's described here, would bring about that sort of a result in just a natural kind of way. It's not purely a physical effect. It involves an intervention by God who sanctioned this procedure for the purpose specified to determine the innocence of the woman. Now, having said that, the procedure resembles, to a certain degree, not completely, but to a certain degree, what is known as trial by ordeal. No one's ever heard of that, that phrase, or that descriptive term, trial by ordeal. Trial by ordeal has a long history among many people over a long period of time. If you go to the Code of Hammurabi, that's about 1700 BC, well, 132 reads, if the finger is pointed at the wife of a citizen on account of another man, but she has not been caught lying with another man, in other words, again, no evidence, for her husband's sake, she shall throw herself into the river. And of course, the theory was, if she was guilty, she'd drown. If she was innocent, she would survive. That's trial by ordeal. Pardon? Yeah, there's some similarities there. The Columbia Encyclopedia says, trial by ordeal is legal proof by divine intervention in a case where normal evidence does not exist. If you look at the history of this, you'll find that it's often ordealed by water or by fire. Sometimes people were required to walk across hot coals of fire, and then the severity of the burns would be inspected after a period of time. If it was severe burns, that would indicate guilt. If it wasn't, that would indicate innocence. To put a hand in the flame, a similar examination would be good. So often, this procedure has been compared to trial by ordeal. It's found throughout history, in the ancient Near East and other places, in the Middle Ages in Europe at this late time, it was in common in England, so the jury system was developed. But I think there's an important difference. I said it resembled to some degree trial by ordeal, but notice there is a difference. In trial by ordeal, as normally practiced, there is an assumption of guilt unless proved innocent. Oh, if you walk on poles, you're going to probably get burnt. So there is normally in the ordeal an assumption of guilt unless proven innocent. That is, unless the person is delivered from the fire or the water. But here the ritual is really the opposite. There is an assumed innocence unless proven guilty. The danger here is not life-threatening or something that you would expect would cause severe injury of any sort. Simply drinking the water mixed with dust. And if then the thigh rots and the abdomen swells after a period of time, the woman is shown to be guilty. So I think that's an important distinction. And it seems that the Lord ordered this to be a procedure to be followed in a case like this. In a social context where women were generally disadvantaged, and this provision really, in many respects, is to the woman's benefit. It forces a suspicious husband to establish his case or desist from accusations, suspicion, and the procedure can do that. Yeah. All right, let's go on to E. The law of the Nazarite. I don't know why these batteries always die on me. I put the last one in here. it wasn't that long ago, a couple weeks ago, so everybody else must use it and I replace the battery. is the law of the Nazarite. Another provision here for a particular situation. Numbers 6, 1 to 21. The title for this you will find in verse 13 and in verse 21. You notice in verse 13 of chapter 6, now this is the law of the Nazarite. In verse 21, this is the law of the Nazarite. What was the purpose of the law of the Nazarite? The law of the Nazarite provided for a type of special consecration to the Lord for someone, either male or female, who were not of the priesthood, that enabled them to set themselves apart to the Lord for a limited amount of time, it was something that was not obligatory but voluntary. It was not some sort of monasticism or asceticism. It permitted a rather normal life in society, but with a few qualifications or exceptions. So if you read in the first verse of chapter 6, the Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord as a Nazarite, he must do certain things." I might say the word Nazarite comes from the root Nazar, Nun Zion Resh, which means to dedicate or separate. So there's a play on the root meaning of that word there, a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord. The three things the Nazarite was not to do were things that were not wrong in themselves, but things that marked this special period of consecration to the Lord. The first thing, verse 3 and 4, was abstaining from everything that comes from the grapevine. He must abstain from wine and other fermented drink. Must not drink vinegar made from wine or from other fermented drink. He must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. As long as he is a Nazarite, he must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seeds of the skin. The second thing was he was to let his hair grow as a symbol of dedication to the Lord. Verse 5. During the entire period of his vow of separation, no razor may be used on his head. He must be holy until the period of his separation to the Lord is over. He must let the hair of his head grow long. And thirdly, verses 6 and 7, he was not to come in contact with any dead body. Throughout the period of his separation to the Lord, he must not go near a dead body, even if his own father or mother or brother or sister dies. He must not make himself ceremonially unclean on account of them, because the symbol of his separation to God is on his head. So those are the three things that the Nazarite was to do. At the end of the vow, various offerings or sacrifices were to be made. The head was to be shaved, the hair burned on the altar, and the period of that vow was terminated. So that's the law of the Nazarite. I might just comment here. If you look at the history of the Christian church, you're probably aware that in the Roman Catholic Church, there's a long tradition of requiring people to take vows, and particularly for the priesthood, of celibacy, poverty, chastity, and obedience. And to do so for one's entire life, that, I think, system has led to a lot of problems. And particularly in the monastic system, I think there's the not biblical concept that celibacy is a holier state than matrimony, and that withdrawal from normal social intercourse, normal involvement in society and the community is something that is more conducive to spiritual growth and true religion than active involvement in society. So it's interesting that in this particular vow that a person can take, it is voluntary and it's temporary. It's not something that is imposed for a lifetime, and it's not something that totally withdraws someone from normal activity. Question.
Would the person make a vow for a certain period of time before one? So would he say, I'm going to do this for 2 months and then keep the vow? I mean, it just seems like if your brother or sister died and you wanted to be decorated, you should say, let me break the vow today.
I'm not sure if it tells to terminate it, how long that takes. I'm not sure if that's specified. Let's see. Doesn't appear like it would take that long a time to terminated, so maybe a person could, I don't know, it would probably be a matter of conscience. I don't think that is specifically addressed. I think later in Judaism there was the attempt to specify the length, you know, it would be for a period of a month or 6 weeks or 2 months or something, but in the law itself it's not. All right, let's go on to F. I just want to make a few brief comments here. F is the offering of the princes at the dedication of the altar, number 7, 1-89. I might say that this is the longest chapter in the Pentateuch. It's how many verses? 89 verses, chapter 7. And if you glance down through it, you'll find it very repetitive. It describes the offering that's brought by a representative of each of the tribes on this occasion of the dedication of the altar of the tabernacle. And for example, if you look at verse 24, on the third day, Eliab, son of Helon, the leader of the people of Zebulun, brought his offering. So the representative from the tribe of Zebulun brings an offering. The offering is then described in verses 25 through 29. His offering was one silver plate weighing 130 shekels, one silver sprinkling bowl weighing 70 shekels, both according to sanctuary shekel, each filled with fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering, one gold dish weighing 10 shekels filled with incense, one young bull, one ram, one male lamb a year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs a year old to be sacrificed as a fellowship offering. This was the offering of Eliab, son of Helon. And if you look at each of the descriptions of the other offerings of the representatives of the other tribes, they're all identical. So the chapter becomes very repetitive. And you might ask, what's the point? Seems to me that what it's telling us is God is interested in each one of his people and their offerings, even though those offerings may be basically the same. God is personally interested in each of his people, in each of these tribes, and in what they bring. And so it's recorded, offering after offering after offering. Let's go on to G, the second Passover after leaving Egypt. Numbers chapter 9, the first 14 verses. There's a time designation In verse 1 of chapter 9, the Lord spoke to Moses in the desert of Sinai. In the first month of the second year after they came out of Egypt, he said to have the Israelites celebrate a Passover at the appointed time. Celebrate at the appointed time at twilight on the 14th day of this month. Now, notice that time. First month of the second year. Go back to Numbers 1:1. Numbers 1:1 says, the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of Midian, desert of Sinai, on the first day of the second month of the second year. First day of the second month of the second year. This is the first month of the second year. So this is actually earlier than the instructions there in chapter 1 about taking the census. But what happens at this time is they did that on the first month of the second year. But you read in verse 6, some of them could not celebrate the Passover on that day because they were ceremonially unclean on account of a dead body. So they came to Moses and Aaron and said to Moses, we have become unclean because of a dead body, but why should we be kept from presenting the Lord's offering with the other Israelites at the appointed time? In other words, they're obligated to observe the Passover, but they're ceremonially unclean, so they can't observe the Passover. And you have a problem of conflicting laws. All Israelites were to observe the Passover or be cut off from God's people. If you go down to verse 13, if a man who is ceremonially clean and not on a journey fails to celebrate the Passover, that man must be cut off from his people because he did not present the Lord's offering at the appointed time. That man will bear the consequences of his sin. But if you go back to the Mosaic legislation in Leviticus, anyone who had touched a dead body was unclean and was prohibited from observing the Passover. So what do you do in such cases? You're supposed to observe it, but you can't because you're unclean. And these people come to Moses and say, what should we do? And Moses doesn't know. Verse 8, Moses says, wait until I find out what the Lord commands concerning you. And then you read in verse 9 what the Lord tells Moses. He says, tell the Israelites, when any of you or your descendants are unclean because of a dead body or are away on a journey, they may still celebrate the Lord's Passover. They are to celebrate it on the 14th month, day of the second month. That's why. In other words, a later date. An alternative is given. And I think you see in this something important with respect to the nature of the civil and ceremonial law. I don't think this law was intended to be perceived in a narrowly legalistic way. That is, it's not something totally unbending and unchanging. And I think what Jesus said in Mark 2:27 gets at the same point. Jesus says, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This law is given by God for the benefit of humankind. It's not that, it's not the other way around. And what the Lord does here is provide a way of maintaining the best of both these requirements. You must observe the Passover. You must not do it when you were unclean, without really compromising either. But provision is made for exceptions and conflicts. So a second Passover could be held a month after the regular Passover. in order to accommodate people who could not participate in the first because of either being unclean or being away on a journey. H under 12. Divine provision for direction and guidance. Israel is now to start, leave Sinai, start out on their journey toward the land of Canaan. And two provisions are made. In 9:15 to 23, you have the pillar of cloud and fire. You read, on the day of the tabernacle, this is verse 15 of 9. On the day of the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony was set up. The cloud covered it from evening till morning. The cloud above the tabernacle looked like fire. That is how it continued to be. The cloud covered it, and at night it looked like fire. Whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent, the Israelites set out. Whenever the cloud settled, the Israelites encamped. At the Lord's command, the Israelites set out. At His command, they encamped. As long as the cloud stayed over the tabernacle, they remained in camp. So, the rest of it describes how that was to work to lead the Israelites on their journey. The second provision is in 10:1 to 10. And that's the provision of providing silver trumpets to coordinate the movements of the tribes. The Lord said, make two trumpets of hammered silver. Use them for calling the community together and for having the camp set out. When both are sounded, the whole community is assembled before you and so forth. So, those provisions for the guidance of the people as they set out from Sinai. Okay. I'm going to skip on your outlines as far as last discussion. Section E, F, and G. You notice E is from Sinai to the plains of Moab, Numbers 10 through 22. F is the Balaam incident in Numbers 22 to 25. That's where Balak, king of Moab, hired Balaam, a heathen soothsayer, to curse the Israelites, and he ends up blessing Israel instead of cursing them. I do want to make a couple comments on that. I'll come back to it in a minute. But I'm not going to discuss E, F, or G. G is preparations for entrance into Canaan, chapters 26 to 36, where you have discussion of a new census and some things right at the end of that period of the wilderness wandering. I said I did want to make a few comments on the Balaam articles. And I want to do that in connection with one specific thing that is included in those articles. And that's a reference to the rise of kingship in Israel. You notice what Balaam says in 23:21. He says, no misfortune is seen in Jacob, no misery observed in Israel. The Lord their God is with them. The shout of the king is among them. Now, you could debate what the shout of the king is a reference to there. Is the king their God himself? The Lord their God is with them. The shout of the king is a shout of the recognition of Yahweh as the divine king, or is this a human hit? Look at 24:17, where Balaam in his fourth article says, I see him but not now, I behold him but not near. A star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise out of Israel. Now, a scepter is a symbol of royalty. He will crush the foreheads of Moab, the skulls of all the sons of Seth. Edom will be conquered. Seir, his enemy, will be conquered. But Israel will grow strong. A ruler will come out of Jacob and destroy the survivors of the city. I think in 17 to 19, you have a really prophetic statement that finds its fulfillment in the time of David. See, David was the scepter who rose out of Israel. David crushed Moab and Edom. You look at 2 Samuel 8, it lists all of David's conquests, and among them are Moab and Edom. And kingship, what I just wanted to call your attention to, is kingship is anticipated already in the Baal of Oracles. We get into 1st, 2nd Samuel, you'll see the rise of kingship in Israel. Kingship doesn't arise in Israel without any intimation in advance that there would be a time when kingship would be established in Israel. In fact, if you go back to the time of Abraham, the Lord says, among Abraham's descendants, kings will arise. We haven't come to Deuteronomy yet, but in Deuteronomy chapter 17, we'll look at that very shortly. There's what's called the law of the king. When you establish a king, here's what the king shall do. So, kingship is anticipated. It doesn't appear on the scene without some prior indication in Scripture that it was God's purpose for his people to have a king. So I did want to make that comment on the Baal of Oracles. But I want to move forward, as I mentioned. Skip E, F, and G. Go forward to H, which is Moses' last days. Two subpoints. One is the book of Deuteronomy, and two is the death of Moses. Under the book of Deuteronomy, there are three subheads. First of which is the name again. This is the last of the five books of the Pentateuch, as we have noted. In Hebrew tradition, the title is taken from some words from the first lines of the book. In this case, the title with which we are familiar is not from the Hebrew tradition, but from the Septuagint. In the Hebrew tradition, you see the bottom there, Deuteronomy 1:1 is Elah Hadibarim Asher Deber Moshe. These are the words which Moses spoke unto Israel beyond the Jordan. These are the words that Elah Hadibarim. These are the words is the title in Jewish tradition. But the title we're familiar with, Deuteronomy, is really derived from the Septuagint translation of Deuteronomy 17:18. Now, I mentioned a few minutes ago that Deuteronomy contains what's often called the law of the king, that describes how a king was to function when kingship arose in Israel. This verse, 17:18, is a verse from that law of the king. And it says, when he, and that is the king, takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll, NIV says, a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are the Levites. So you see in the Hebrew text there, the red lettering, he is to write for him a copy of this law. That is translated in the Septuagint deuteronomium tuto. He is to write literally this second law. Now, the Mishneh there in the Hebrew is a word that can mean either copy or second. And you see the Septuagint's translated it, this second law. I think that's a mistranslation. And it is, it has become in English the title for the book, this second law, Deuteronomy, Deuteronomion, it means second law. In the tuto, this second law. It's a mistranslation, and it's open to misunderstanding. I think it can be understood correctly and, in a sense, be helpful. But it is open to misunderstanding, and I think it has often been understood in wrong ways. If you translate it, second law, you might get the idea that this is a second law that differs from the first law. First law was given at Sinai. This is a law that's given 40 years later to the new generation that grew up during the wilderness time. You remember, because of the lack of faith, when they were at Kadesh Barnea, in the middle of the book of Numbers, we didn't look at that, but the spies were sent up, came back, said, there's no way we can conquer this land. And then they were judged by the Lord and condemned to 38 years more of wandering in the wilderness. So, a second law could be understood as a law that differs from that which was given at Sinai. There's an element of truth in that. Because if you look closely at the formulation of the laws in Deuteronomy as compared to the formulation of the laws in Exodus, you will find in some cases there are slight differences. Some of the Ten Commandments are worded a little bit differently in Deuteronomy 5 than they are in Exodus chapter 20. But what should not be concluded from this is that this is a second law that is in any way inconsistent or contrary to the law that had been given at Sinai. This is simply, you might say, a restatement of the law by Moses to the next generation of people in a way that was consistent and harmonious with the law given at Sinai. It's not a second law in the sense that it is a different body of material than that which was given at Sinai. So that's one way in which it could be understood, and not misunderstood. A second way it could be misunderstood is that the title implies this is simply a repetition of the first law. And if that's the case, why should we pay a whole lot of attention to Deuteronomy? Let's just read Exodus and Leviticus, and is this just simply a repetition of what had been given before? Why do we have the book of Deuteronomy? It's interesting that in the Samaritan Pentateuch text of Deuteronomy, as well as in the Dead Sea Scroll text of Deuteronomy, you see attempts made to harmonize Deuteronomy with the wording of the laws of Exodus and Numbers, so that the differences between the two are minimized, you might say. There seems to be an attempt to kind of draw the wording closer together in the Dead Sea Scroll text and the Samaritan Pentateuch text as compared with the Masoretic text. But a more accurate translation of the Hebrew phrase is simply a copy of this law, not a second law. King was to write a copy of this law, why the Septuagint translators translated the way they did, and then why that became the title from the book is an open question. If you go back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 18, you can still ask the question, what is the law in view? The king is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law. A copy of what law? Is it just the law of the king that's to govern the way he performs his job as king? Or is it this law, the whole of the Pentateuch? Or is it the whole of the book of Deuteronomy? I think those are three options here. I'm inclined to think it's probably the book of Deuteronomy. He needs to have a copy of this restatement of the law by Moses on the plains of Moab to guide him as he assumes the responsibilities of king. But I think, just to draw this discussion to a conclusion on the title, the derivation of the title from the translation of this phrase in Deuteronomy 17:18 has provided a title for the book that can be misunderstood. And it's a title that I don't think was intended in any way in the original composition or in the words of the text from which it is derived. Now, having said that, the other options go with the Jewish tradition. And if you do that, you're down here to these are the words. Deuteronomy probably conveys more of the idea properly understood of what's in the book than does the title in Jewish tradition of these are the words, which doesn't know as much of anything. All right, let's go on to B, unless there's a question. B is the significance of Deuteronomy in the Old Testament canon. Let me start this with a citation on page 45. There are some paragraphs on page 45 from an interesting little book by Samuel Schultz, who for a long time was on the faculty of Wheaton College in their graduate school, part Old Testament subject. He wrote a book called Deuteronomy, the Gospel of Love, which is a popular book. It's not a technical academic kind of discussion of Deuteronomy, but the ideas that he expressed in that book I found quite helpful. Notice the first paragraph, paragraph A. He says, the book of Deuteronomy, it's quite a striking statement, is the most important book in the Old Testament from the standpoint of God's revelation to them. I don't know if somebody asks you what's the most important book in the Old Testament. Would your mind go to Deuteronomy? Probably not. You might say Genesis or Isaiah, Psalms. But that's what he says. He says, for years in his teaching of Old Testament survey, the author made only brief references to Deuteronomy as a book which merely reviews or repeats what precedes in the Pentateuch. See there, Deuteronomy, simply a repetition of what goes before. Why pay attention to it? Such, however, is not the case. It is one of the books most frequently cited and referred to in the New Testament, nearly 200 times, according to the Greek New Testament, edited by Lon Blackmetzger and Wichter. So he makes that statement, which I think is quite striking. Whether you would agree with that conclusion or not, I think you can certainly say and would have to admit that Deuteronomy plays an enormously important role in Old Testament revelation. We're going to say more about this later, but when you get beyond Deuteronomy, the theology and the concepts of all of the historical books
Joshua judges Samuel kings reflect the theology of Deuteronomy. And the influence of Deuteronomy in the prophetical books, in many cases, is quite striking. So Deuteronomy is a very significant book. Let's get the setting and the background for this. Israel had entered into covenant with the Lord at Sinai after that remarkable deliverance out of Egypt. And at Sinai, God made known the obligations that his covenant entailed. And Israel left Sinai, as I mentioned, because of their lack of faith. A whole generation died in the wilderness. The new generation has now come to the border of the land of Canaan, just across the Jordan River in the plains of Moab, where they were camped. And what Moses does in this book is summarize for this new generation what it is that the Lord expects from them as his people. And he challenges this new generation to walk in the way of the Lord, to be obedient to their covenantal obligations. And I think you can say the book of Deuteronomy is as much sermonic as it is legal. If you look at the structure of the book, you find there are three addresses of Moses. And he's really preaching to the Israelites and challenging them to live up to their covenant obligation. Now, look at what Schultz says in paragraph B on page 45. Moses is preaching. And Schultz says the word love is at the heart of the message. Neither list of do's or don'ts, nor law, nor legalism, nor rules for living, nor good works, nor even a high moral standard was primarily in focus. Basic to all of these was a vital relationship with God, a relationship of love. Out of this love relationship issued all other considerations that were important to man. Love for man was initiated by God, did not come in response to human action or activity. Although God's tender care had been bestowed upon all mankind, God's love for Israel began with his choice of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God's love was manifested to the entire nation through their miraculous deliverance from Egypt. As a recipient of God's love, which was evident in his redemption and constant care, the Israelite was expected to respond with wholehearted love and devotion. This response tapped all the resources of his entire being, his heart, soul, mind, and strength. This love and devotion was exclusive. No other gods could be allowed or tolerated in such a relationship. Now again, look at the context for that. I think Schultz is absolutely right in calling attention to this word love being at the heart of the message. We'll look at some examples of that in a minute. But at the time in which Moses is addressing Israel on the plains of Moab, Israel was about to go into the land of Canaan and settle down among the heathen people of the land of Canaan, be exposed to their customs, to their gods, to their religious practices. And the question before Israel was, would they adopt the practices of the Canaanites, accept the Canaanite deities, or would they remain loyal to the Lord? After immediately after Moses had gone up the mountain there after the initial establishment of the covenant, what did Israel do in the matter of worship? They went into that golden calf worship. And now you have a new generation. What's this new generation do on the plains of Moab? Look at Numbers 25. This is one of the passages we didn't look at. But you read in 25:1, while Israel was staying in Shittim, Shittim is a place in the plains of Moab, just across from the land of Canaan. Just to get that setting, look at Joshua 2:1. Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim. Look at Joshua 3:1. Early morning, Joshua and all Israel set out from Shittim, went to the Jordan, where they camped for crossing over. So you see they're camped there in this place, ready to cross into the land of Canaan. And what happens? 25:1, while they were in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women who invited them to sacrifices to their gods. The people ate and bowed down before these gods. So Israel joined in worshiping the Baal of Peor. The Lord's anger burned against Israel. So here's this new generation on the plains of Moab in Shittim, about to cross into the promised land. They're getting drawn into heathen worship. So I think Deuteronomy is to be read with that background in mind. Moses is appealing to the Israelites to remain faithful to the Lord exclusively, to love Him with all their heart, mind, and soul. And that love and devotion was to be a response to His gracious and mighty acts on their behalf. He had delivered them out of Egypt. He had brought them to Sinai. He had entered into covenant with them, given His law. Remember that law, it's grace, law, grace. It's the law was a means of grace to be obeyed and to expect blessing. So Schultz says at the heart of the message of Moses here on the plains of Moab is it's not just do's or don'ts, it's love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. And it's exclusive to be to Yahweh alone. Look at great and famous text of Deuteronomy, the Shema, 6:4, Deuteronomy 6:4 through 4 and 5. Hear, O Israel, Yahweh, our God, Yahweh is one, and then what follows? See, that's the heart of the message. Love Yahweh, your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These commandments I give you today are to be upon your hearts, and impress them on your children, talk about them when you sit down, and so forth. Verse 4, it's difficult to translate. If you look at that in Hebrew, you'll see there's certain ambiguity in it. NIV says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. But in my copy, there's an end text note. And if you look at that N, it says, or, the Lord our God is one Lord, or, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, or, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. I'm inclined to think that last one is probably the best translation. The Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Therefore, love Yahweh with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But in any case, love is at the heart of the message. Go back to Schultz. Paragraph C, page 45. Out of the unique relationship with his God, the Israelite was to express his love horizontally to his neighbor. Only as he experienced being loved by God was he qualified to extend love to his neighbor. A keen realization of God's love provided the wellspring that enabled the Israelite to love his fellow man in the true sense. It is this vertical and horizontal love relationship that Jesus pinpointed as the essence of all that God required of man to attain eternal salvation. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, what does God require? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. That vertical, horizontal relationship. The expert Mosaic law representing the Pharisees concurred with Jesus that the law of love was more important than all the considerations. It was in the book of Deuteronomy that Jesus and the religious leaders found the core of God's revelation to man in written form. Jesus also pointed out that this represented the essence of all that is written in the law and the prophets. Consequently, we do well to study this book, which provides us insight and understanding in the context of the context in which this divine concept of love was revealed through and stated by Moses. That dual emphasis that's found in the book, love for God, but then the horizontal relationship, love your neighbor as yourself. And the concluding statement that I have here from Schultz is D, paragraph D. These two responsibilities, complete love for God and love for neighbor, constituted the essence of what God required of man. This was the core of God's message to man as revealed through Moses at Horeb. Then notice the next statement, because I think this is where Deuteronomy is often misunderstood. And part of that, again, is the title. We will know God's second law. Not legalism. Not ritual. Not external minutiae of religious observance. Not a legalistic observance of the Decalogue or a system of negatives and positive principles or creed. None of these was basic. Rather, Moses emphasized a vital relationship with God as fundamental to all other issues in life. Second to this was a genuine love relationship with fellow man. Now, I think Schultz is right on that, on the basic perspective you get from Moses' sermons on the plains of Moab. We've looked at Deuteronomy 6:4, but look at chapter 10. Verse 12 and following. And now, O Israel, what does the Lord your God ask of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him? What's God want? Fear him, love him, serve the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, to observe the Lord's commands and decrees that I am giving you today for your own good. Look at chapter 30, verse 11 and following. I'm going to come back to chapter 11 in a minute, but let's go to 30 first. 30, verse 11 to 20. Now, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It's not up in heaven, so that you have to ask who will ascend into heaven to get it and proclaim it to us so we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea, so you have to ask who will cross the sea to get it and proclaim it to us so we may obey it. No, the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to what? To love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away, and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn away to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day that you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and cursings. Now choose life so that you and your children may live, and that you may, what? See, here it is again. Love the Lord your God. Listen to his voice. Hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give to your father, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So that emphasis comes through repeatedly in the book. I said I want to go back to chapter 11. Now let's go further for a break. Chapter 11, I think, kind of summarizes the message of the book in a nutshell, in a very brief description of what the Lord desires from his people. Let's look at the way that chapter begins. What's it say in verse 1? Love the Lord your God and keep his requirements, his decrees, his laws, and his commands always. And what follows is a description of God's mighty acts on behalf of his people. You go down to verse 7. You read, it was your own eyes that saw all these great things the Lord has done. What are the great things the Lord has done? Well, they were deliverances. Look at verses 2 to 4. Remember today that your children were not the ones who saw and experienced the discipline of the Lord your God, his majesty, his mighty hand, his outstretched arm, the signs he performed, the things he did in the heart of Egypt, both the Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and his whole country. What he did to the Egyptian armies, to its horses, the chariots, how he overwhelmed them with the waters of the Red Sea as they were pursuing you, how the Lord brought lasting ruin on them. What did your children saw? It was you, with your own eyes. You saw those deliverances of the Lord. In verse 5, they saw provision for their needs. It was not your children who saw what he did for you in the desert until you arrived at this place. He provided the manna, he provided the water, the clothes that did not wear out. What else did he provide? Verse 6, discipline and judgment. And what he did to Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab the Reubenite, when the earth opened its mouth in the middle of all Israel, swallowed them up with their household, their tents, every living thing that belonged to them. But it was your own eyes that saw all these great things the Lord had done. Question.
But isn't it true that it really wasn't their eyes? It was, in that generation, died in the desert.
Well, these were the ones under the age of 21. So they're, you know, the census figure, the ones that died were 21 and older, the men of war. So these were the younger generation, and probably some that were born along the way as well. But a lot of them undoubtedly did see it. Now, that knowledge of the past, the way God had delivered them, sustained them, and even judged them, provides a basis for what to expect in the future. Israel could know that if they were faithful to the Lord, that they would experience his blessing in the future. Notice what follows. In verse 8, observe therefore all the commands I am giving you today, so that you may have the strength to go in and take over the land that you are crossing the Jordan to possess. They are obedient, they will possess the land. And they will retain possession of the land. Verse 9. So that you may live long in the land that the Lord swore to your forefathers to give them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. And if they observe the commands in verse 10 to 17, they will prosper in the land. The land you are entering to take over is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you planted your seed and irrigated it by foot as in a vegetable garden, but the land you are crossing the Jordan to take possession is a land of mountains and valleys that drinks rain from heaven. It is the land that the Lord your God cares for. The eyes of the Lord are continually on it from the beginning of the year to its end. So, if you faithfully obey the commands I'm giving you today, what again? To love the Lord your God, to serve Him with all your heart, with all your soul. Then, if you faithfully obey, then I will send rain on your land, the autumn, spring rains, so you may gather your grain, new wine, oil, provide grass in the fields for your cattle. You will eat and be satisfied. Be careful, or you will be enticed to turn away and worship other gods and bow down to them. Then the Lord's anger will burn against you. He will shut the heavens, so it will not rain. The ground will not yield produce, and you will soon perish from the good land the Lord has given you. But they'll possess the land, they'll retain possession, they'll prosper in the land if they obey, and they will be victorious against the inhabitants of the land. That's verses 22 to 25. See, 22 says, if you observe all these commands, to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, hold fast in, then the Lord will drive out all these nations. You will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you. Every place where you set your foot will be yours. Your territory will extend from the Lebanon, from the Euphrates River to the Western Sea. No man will be able to stand against you. The Lord your God, as He promised you, will put the terror and fear of you on the whole land, wherever you go. So that's set out before Israel. They are to love the Lord, walk in His ways. He will bless them in the ways described. But what follows in verses 26-32 are the alternatives that are open to Israel, and the choice is theirs. If they obey, they will experience God's blessing. If they disobey, they will experience His curse. Let's look at 26 and 5. Moses says, see, I am setting before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commands of the Lord your God that I'm giving you today, the curse if you disobey the commands and turn away from the way I command you by following other gods you have not known. When the Lord your God has brought you into the land you are entering to possess, you are to proclaim on Mount Gerizim the blessings and on Mount Ebal the curses. As you know, these mountains are across the Jordan, west of the road toward the setting sun, near the great trees of Moreh, in the territory of those Canaanites living in the Arabah in the vicinity of Gilead. You are about to cross the Jordan to enter and take possession of the land the Lord your God has given you. When you have taken it over and are living there, be sure that you obey all the decrees and laws I am setting before you today. So there's Moses' challenge. Be obedient. You will experience God's blessing. If you are disobedient, you will experience His curse and guilt. And that challenge really provides the perspective from which Israel's experience as a nation subsequent to entering the land of Canaan is to be understood. You don't go very far forward in time. During the life of Joshua, things were pretty stable. But you get to the next book, the book of Judges. And you get in the book of Judges, you have this cycle of Israel turning away from the Lord, experiencing His judgment. And they are oppressed by various peoples. And then they cry out to the Lord, and they're delivered. And they have peace and rest and blessing. And then they go through the cycle again, and it's repeated. And it's not just like a repeating of a cycle, we get to Judges. It's really a downward spiral. Things get worse and worse. The end of the book of Judges, there's complete chaos. Because they have not followed the pattern that Moses sets out before them when they're here to enter the land of Canaan. So, I think you can say that Deuteronomy is foundational to understanding what follows in the remaining books of the Old Testament, both the historical and prophetic books, because Israel's history followed this pattern. The provisions of this covenant worked themselves out and were realized depending upon whether or not Israel walked in the ways of the Lord and loved the Lord exclusively. And the Lord sent his prophets constantly, repeatedly, to call Israel back to the way of the covenant and to be faithful to those Mosaic foundations. And in many cases, to pronounce the covenant curses of judgment because they had turned away. So, the book of Deuteronomy is enormously important as far as setting the foundation for all that follows in the remainder of the Old Testament. Question, comment? I might say that chapter 11, if you get back to that treaty structure, remember we talked about how Deuteronomy basically followed that pattern. Chapter 11 is really, I would say, in the category of that basic stipulation. You're to love the Lord. That fundamental obligation of loyalty. You see the way chapter 12 begins. You move from the basic stipulation in chapter 11 to the detailed stipulations that follow. 12 begins, these are the decrees and the laws you must be careful to follow. And there you get the detailed description of the obligations of the covenant that follows. All right. You notice on your outline, I want to say something about dates. And we already talked a bit about that, but I want to say a little bit more. And then to the death of Moses, a couple brief comments. But before doing that, let's take our break. Take 15 minutes, so come back to order.